From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today is our special summer reading show on The Art of the Matter.
We'll be replaying a few of our favorite interviews with local authors from the past couple months,
including my interviews with juvenile fiction author John Green, as well as with Rita Rose, who talks about her fictionalized biography of The World's Tallest Woman.
And I'll chat with college student and author Jordan Lyons. And of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All this and more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter. Today is our special summer reading show where we revisit a number of favorite interviews with local authors from the past few months. We'll start with my interview with John Green, which originally aired the first week of January.
Quentin Jacobson, known to his eclectic band of geeky friends as Q, has spent a lifetime loving his adventurous classmate and neighbor Margot Roth Spiegelman from afar. Well, one late spring night, as they near high school graduation, Margot appears at Q's window and invites him out for an all-night ingenious campaign of revenge, and then disappears. As Q and his friends try to put together the pieces of the puzzle of Margot, they learn unexpected lessons about themselves and about life. This is the story that unfolds in Paper Town, the new novel by John Green. Green, winner of the Michael L. Prince Medal for Excellence in Young Adult Literature, dropped in to talk with Sharon Gamble about Paper Towns.
The way I figure it, everyone gets a miracle. Like, I'll probably never be struck by lightning or win a Nobel Prize or become the dictator of a small nation in the Pacific Islands or contract terminal ear cancer or spontaneously combust. But if you consider all the unlikely things together, at least one of them will probably happen to each of us. I could have seen it rain frogs. I could have stepped foot on Mars. I could have been eaten by a whale. I could have married the Queen of England or survived months at sea. But my miracle was different. My miracle was this. Out of all the houses, in all the subdivisions, in all of Florida, I ended up living next door to Margot Roth Spiegelman. Our subdivision, Jefferson Park, used to be a Navy base, but then the Navy didn't need it anymore, so it returned the land to the citizens of Orlando, Florida, who decided to build a massive subdivision, because that's what Florida does with land. My parents and Margot's parents ended up moving next door to one another just after the first houses were built. Margot and I were two. Before Jefferson Park was a Pleasantville and before it was a Navy base, it belonged to an actual Jefferson, this guy Dr. Jefferson Jefferson. Dr. Jefferson Jefferson has a school named after him and also a large charitable foundation, but the fascinating and unbelievable but true thing about Dr. Jefferson Jefferson is that he was not a doctor of any kind. He was just an orange juice salesman named Jefferson Jefferson. When he became rich and powerful, he went to court, made Jefferson his middle name, and changed his first name to Doctor, capital D, lowercase r, period.
This is a book about remarkable things that happen, and that's a great setup, you know, the improbability of Dr. Jefferson Jefferson among the many wonderful things that happen in this journey of a book. It's kind of like a Siddhartha or one of those great self-discovery novels, but updated for a modern kid.
Yeah, well, I was thinking a lot about our great tales of adventure in America, Huck Finn and Moby Dick, and also thinking about Pilgrim's Progress, which was a book that was very influential for me. And obviously, a lot of the novel centers around Walt Whitman's poetry. So I was thinking about all of those sort of great writers before me, better than me, it must be said, who have captured what it means to be adventurous, both inside and outside.
Now, you're not the same age as the narrator, and it's probably not an autobiographical novel in any real way, but how did you remember what it felt like to be just there on the cusp of adulthood, but still young enough to not know yourself very well? How did you access that?
Well, I think that I don't know myself very well. I mean, I think that's a nearly universal problem among adults and teenagers alike is sort of limited self-awareness and an even more limited ability to imagine what it's like to be other people, which is also at the core of Favor Towns. So in that sense, you know, I had the benefit of being able to write about the person I am. But no, I just try to write in a way that I think is true to high school experience and true to being 17. There's no magical act of channeling or anything. I think that it's just an act of imagination.
There are the narrator is a charmingly quirky, geeky, and I mean that as a compliment.
Yeah.
Kid who, and I'll tell you, one of the really refreshing things about this book is he has a pretty good relationship with his parents.
Yeah.
Shocking. They're therapists, and I think he gets a little over their talk and sometimes wants them to just be mad about something, right?
Right. They're a little bit lame, but they're good parents, like most parents. I mean, I think that parents like to see themselves at the center of the life of a teenager, but the fact is that for most teenagers, parents, good parents fade into the background. You know, a good parent is like a good font. It sort of disappears. So that's difficult for parents to accept.
Wait, do you have children yet?
I don't.
Okay.
So
well, I'm going to save this interview. We're going to play it back when you have kids and they're old enough
sure.
to talk.
I'm sure when I have a teenager, I'm going to want to be an important presence in their lives. But
it's good to have that awareness, though. But I mean, this young man has a cast of friends. And schoolmates who are identifiable no matter who you were, whether you were the jock kid, the kid who was in band, the geeky intellectual kid. These are, while they are distinct characters and charming and wonderful and quirky characters, they're also really recognizable no matter mm-hmm. how old you are when you went to high school.
Yeah. Well, that's something that's important to me is to try to capture the reality of the social casting in American high schools that people have to fill certain roles in this crazy sort of inverse pyramid that is the high school social scene. So I wanted to capture that, but I also wanted to capture the ways that can break down in this book after Margot leaves. One of the main characters in the book disappears. After that happens, things really start to break apart in terms of who's cool and who isn't, and the power dynamic shifts dramatically, which tends to happen, I think, in a lot of senior classes, not just where something dramatic happens. And I know it happened in mine, and it's very fulfilling to have always been a nerd and to suddenly have friends.
We won't delve into that too much. So essentially, the novel opens. I'm trying to figure out how to talk about this without giving too much away because.
Don't worry about that. I don't believe in spoilers.
Okay, good to know. Because it really is a mystery. It's a page turner. I found myself staying up, and I'm not even in the target demographic, I imagine, but I'm a grown up, but I found myself staying up later than I should because I wanted to read just one more chapter and see what was going to happen. It opens with a scene from childhood where these two kids who happen to be neighbors but grow out of being peers in a way witness something kind of startling.
Yeah, the opening prologue is a flashback to when these two kids were 9 and they come across a dead body, and it turns out to have been a guy who committed suicide, who shot himself. And they're not able, you know, because Q's parents, the narrator's parents, are therapists, he goes home and gets a good, solid introduction to death, a really healthy introduction to death. And then Margot's parents, his friend, aren't nearly as good at being parents. And you know, I think that for her, it's a very traumatic event, and for him, it's something that happened on a Tuesday. But for her, it's something that shaped her entire, the way that she approaches life for the rest of her childhood and then adolescence.
Fast forward enough years that they're about to graduate high school, and they're still living next door, but Margot Roth-Spiegelman is she who must be admired from afar. She's so cool. She seems to have it all together. And she sends Quentin, Q, on a crazy adventure.
Yeah, so almost 10 years after they last hung out in any meaningful way, she shows up at his bedroom window again in the middle of the night and drags him on this crazy all-night adventure of sort of mission of revenge through the streets of Orlando, Florida, And it's one of those all-nighters that, you know, if you're lucky, you have a couple times in high school where everything just happens perfectly and it just all feels like it's quite magical, which and it culminates with them breaking into SeaWorld, which is a bit of a rite of passage for kids growing up in Central Florida.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, well, I can't speak for all kids. But I wanted to have them have this intense night where the entire time Q thinks that Margot is coming close to him and that something is, they may have a romantic relationship or at least a friendship moving forward, but in fact Q is misreading everything that Margot is saying and doing as he does throughout the entire novel. What's really happening is that she's saying goodbye to Orlando and leaving things the way that she wants to leave them.
And then she disappears and leaves a trail that involves mysterious maps, the Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass, records.
Yeah.
Who knew that she had vinyl?
Vinyl
in her
records.
Room? Good Lord. There's this whole secret vein of Margot Ross Spiegelman that we don't know.
Yeah. And really, the mystery of the novel is not so much the complexity of trying to unlock the clues, it's the complexity of trying to unlock who Margot is and who she was. And that's the challenge for them, because all of the characters in the book have been busy misimagining one another, but particularly misimagining Margot for their entire lives. And so they have to learn to think about her more complexly, as we all do when we're thinking about other people.
She kind of becomes a Rosetta Stone, doesn't she?
Yeah.
Everybody kind of reaches towards her thinking she's one thing, and she ultimately does help all the kids enlighten themselves about who they are and what they want.
Yeah, and they help her. I mean, I wanted it to go both ways. I mean, we learn at the end that Margot has been misimagining Q to basically the same extent that Q has been misimagining Margot all along, that they've both been romanticizing one another. They've both been thinking about the other as sort of more than human, as greater than human. And that was important to me. Yeah, Margot's last name, Spiegelman, is a German word that means mirror maker, like the dude in the German village who made the mirrors was the Spiegelman. And that's very much her role in the book. Every time the characters in the novel look at her, they don't see Margot. They see some funhouse reflection of themselves.
Mm. Now, it's not a coincidence, except maybe one of convenience, you lived in Orlando for a while, but I think there's a particular reason that this novel of self-discovery is set in Orlando.
Yeah, well, it's a great, it's the great American city that you come to and leave. and so I really wanted to write a book about kids who were stuck in various ways, and there is no worse place to be stuck than in Orlando, where you're constantly conscious of people's comings and goings. So that was much on my mind, as was the sort of theme parkization of Florida. And, you know, the book is also about the way we map the world, the relationship between the way we map the world and the world that really is. And that is particularly poignant, I think, in a town like Orlando, where places are constantly being built. But often, because there's so much real estate speculation in Florida, they're imagined and then sort of half-built, and they're forever left unfinished. And that had a nice sort of resonance for me.
There's no there there.
Yeah, there really is no there there.
Sharon Gamble with novelist John Green. His new novel is called Paper Towns, and it's available at bookstores everywhere. John Green has won the Michael L. Prince Medal for Excellence in Young Adult Literature, and has had his works translated into 11 languages. He has won many international awards, and his two previous novels, Looking for Alaska and An Abundance of Catherines, are being developed into films. With his brother Hank Green, John is famous for the popular video series Brotherhood.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Welcome back to The Art of the Matter. Today is our special summer reading show where we revisit a number of favorite interviews with the local authors from the past few months. Next up, a true crime historical thriller set in Philadelphia, but written by a surprisingly young Hoosier. This first aired in May.
Newly published author Jordan Lyons has realistic expectations for his literary debut. "I'm sure it will have all the mistakes of a first novel," he says. "I think I'll get better. I'm only 19. Otherwise occupied with the typical concerns of freshman life at the University of Indianapolis, Lyons has written a book of historical fiction titled The Philadelphia First Ward Horror. The book is based on the true story of the largest mass murder in Philadelphia history, which took place in 1866. Travis D. Nicola spoke with Jordan about his new book.
Jordan, welcome to Art of the Matter.
Hi, thanks a lot.
Pleasure to have you here today. I must say, just first off, congratulations. I'm impressed. Are you 18?
19, actually.
Okay. But, you know, to have your first book under your belt, that's a pretty big accomplishment.
Yeah, it feels good.
I bet. I want to start with sort of how this all came about, because this is a, you know, this historical sort of thriller fiction book, you know, but set, it's not set in Indianapolis. It's not set in present time. It's set in Philadelphia. It's set in the 19th century. You know, most people when they, you know, younger authors, you know, write their first book, it's, you know, much more autobiographical often that sort of thing. And I'm assuming that's not the case here.
No, not at all. Not at all. Philadelphia First Ward Horror, based on the largest mass homicide in Philadelphia city history, 1866, just post-Civil War. Eight people murdered, killed, and there's only one survivor, and from his descendants. One happened to move to Indianapolis a few years ago and is an associate of my father's. And that's how I met this woman and became known to the Deering family, which the book is based on. And so after having heard about the story from the Deerings, I just decided to send a few excerpts their way of maybe how I would have written the story. And the rest is history, quite literally, because they really were impressed and enthused about my take on it. And it just kind of took off from there.
Well, let's start with just the fascination with the story, first of all. I mean, have you always been, you know, like into, you know, thrillers or horror stories? Or,
well,
I mean,
yeah.
It's a pretty gruesome story. As you said, an axe murder with six people?
Eight people. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the word horror is written pretty big there on the cover of the book, and that labels me as well as the book. I can't say I've had a fascination with horror all my life, but certainly the drama of the story appealed to me very much as a writer.
And the writing part, was this something, I mean, had you been in school working, you know, writing short stories, working on other, you know, fiction or other writing before, you know, looking for a subject? Or?
Well, I'd had the desire to be a novelist since I think I was 12 years old was when I really got into some heavy reading. This just kind of came suddenly. I hadn't really had my eye out for anything. I'd just been going along and taking some creative writing classes and poetry and things like that here or there. But when this came along, I found myself with a major project as well as school, as well as carrying a part-time job. And so I had to balance, you know, all the routines of daily life as well as just growing up and, you know, being a kid. So all that together, really, I mean, it worked out pretty well, I think, but, I mean, it was difficult.
So you were, a senior in high school when you started working on this, or?
Yeah, I started, actually, it was February of 2008, so it was my last semester there as a senior, and I finished last Christmas of 2008, so just about 10 months.
I mean, that right there just sort of blows me away, because, I mean, it's like, here it is, your senior year in high school, and then also beginning of your freshman year in college. You're at University of Indianapolis now. You know, I mean, most people are out there, you know, enjoying the summer before they go off to school. I mean, worrying about where you're going to college, you know, sports or dating or hanging out. I mean, writing's a pretty solitary process.
Oh, most definitely. I think I enjoyed my summer in quite a different way. I spent quite a bit of time holed up and locked up in my room and away from the world and civilization, but that's just part of my own personal kind of writing process. But again, you know, the horror of the story, I'm afraid that that's going to be my label. I'm really kind of a happy guy. I'm a nice guy, but, you know, I mean, this is just a story I had, so I had to kind of adapt you know, kind of transform myself into the content of the story.
Well, so the horror of the story, tell us a little bit more about the history of the story and what happened back in 1866.
Well, Philadelphia at that time was, you know, along with the rest of the country, in shambles and disarray, and the economy was just awful. Society was not pretty. Everything was kind of nasty, and the story really, I think, captures that. As far as racism and you know, the war, I mean, I show it in the book in kind of a different way. It's no longer just racism between colors of skin. It's now racism between backgrounds and ethnic groups, and you have, you know, the French and the Dutch and the German and the Irish and the Pole and Swedes and things like that all kind of congregating here in Philadelphia, and that's really the reason for the murder. Farmhand Anton Probst, a German immigrant, worked for Irish immigrants who were very wealthy, mm-hmm. And his motivation for the murder was money, of course, which was never found, and it's a really cool aspect of the story, is that this money that he was after
it's referred to.
Yeah, that's right. That puts a nice spin on it, but really there could be such thing as treasure or some amount of money buried out there in the fields of Philadelphia still today that no one ever found. So
yeah, well, I was wondering about that. I mean, how much of that, you know, is true that you know of? I mean, that they're actually, because obviously, I mean, that's, as you said, it's the motivator in the book. It carries throughout so much of it, and, you know, I was, I have to tell you, I've not finished reading it yet, but I was, you know, the parts I was left wondering, like, you know, is there actually a treasure there?
Yeah, it's very well documented that Christopher Deering, the head of these Irish farmers, had quite a bit of money which he would count out. And Anton Probst was present during these business exchanges, and he got to see this money firsthand. So he knew most definitely that it existed and it was real, but whether it's still there or not, I can't say.
Yeah, but you did do a lot of research on this. I mean, there's a lot of, well, the historical elements, I mean, whether it be the setting, the language, just the feel of the place. I mean, that alone, not just writing the story, but just to do the research, had to be an enormous amount of work.
Yeah, I had huge stacks of paper sitting up in my room, but it was really quite humbling to see pretty authentic and genuine papers from 1866, just kind of sitting around and lazing in my room. So it was really phenomenal to get to work with those things, but it was really research within research, I'd say. I had a lot of collected facts collected by the Deering family over the years, and it was in my job to become acquainted with them better than even the Deerings were, and I now have all kinds of facts and numbers and things running through my head all the time. And I mean, it took me a while to get all the names and ages down of every family member and things like that, but now I know it like the back of my hand.
Did you keep, like, a big chart at all while you were working on this?
Or? I thought about it, and that might have been a better idea, because I did find that there were times I was rummaging through the papers to find a better date or a better street name or a person's name that maybe I misspelled or something like that. But really, at the end of the day, it was about taking all that in, taking the story that I had created in my head along with the factual information and combining them into such a precise way. So it was really research within research, fictional storytelling, and then the combining of the two.
So how much of the story that you came up with, I mean, is what can you tell us as far as, you know, where does your imagination begin here?
See, I kind of like this question because a part of me really wants readers to know and a part of me absolutely doesn't want them to know. But the majority of all the names and places and dates are right on, spot on with the information. I really say more of the context or the plot line would be my own creation or web weaving there. The idea of the treasure and the keys and things of that nature are certainly all my invention. But for the most part, it's all true.
Did you go to Philadelphia at all while you were working on this?
Yeah, I had a chance last summer to go with some members of the Deering family and then my own family and see a lot of these places, which was really cool. That way I had, you know, from last summer on, to be able to picture these places in my mind when I wrote, and that was really helpful.
Yeah, I'm sure. Now, as we mentioned, you're a freshman now, and just finished up your freshman year at University of Indianapolis.
Yep.
And so, you know, you start college with, you know, you're halfway through writing a book, plus you've got everything else going on with college. What did your I mean, you know, your roommates, your friends think, like, you know, here's this guy who's working on his novel? You know, I mean, that's kind of wild.
Well, I kind of kept it a secret for the most part. You know, I only have a few close friends, as a lot of kind of loner writers do, And they really didn't ask too many questions about it. And really even my family, you know, they were very interested to see how it was going and things like that. But for the most part, I really kind of kept it to myself. And I've only just recently, with the release of the novel, really kind of come out. And it catches a lot of people by surprise because a lot of those classmates I spent all year with had no idea I was working on a novel. And then when I had the signing at UIndy a few weeks ago, I had all kinds of people coming up to me and, you know, saying like, hey, you wrote a book. How come you didn't say anything? But I don't know. I just kind of preferred to keep it.
What about your professors? I mean, you're taking some writing classes, right? I mean,
yeah,
did they
actually,
know you were working on that?
I'm actually a history major at UIndy, so I piqued a lot of their interests as well. But the same with them. I really didn't say too much about it, but I really had some great response from them and really a lot of enthusiasm and encouragement from those guys over there.
Well, that's excellent. So what's next on your plate here?
Oh, I've got all kinds of things on the plate. I really didn't want to take a breather even for a minute, so I've got an anthology of short stories I'm working on that will hopefully be finished by the end of the summer. And then after that, I'm hoping to base a novel series on the protagonist in these short stories, something like that. So I figure people really like to get involved and attached to their characters, and that's really the core of my writing, is all character-driven and assessed and developed.
As far as influences for you, you mentioned, you know, that even when you were younger, you as a kid wanted to become a writer. Obviously, you're a reader, and so who's influencing your work as far as what you're who are you learning from?
I'm gonna have to thank my friend Kalen first of all and give him a shout out. He's really been kind of the low-lying influence in all this. He's the one that gave me a book when I was 12 years old and really got me reading. And since then, I've read the same things over and over again, the books he gives me. And so I really got to thank him. But, you know, other than that, it's really, really my family. They always have to be first. I mean, everything, no matter what they do, watching them, you know, at their professions and, you know, what they have chosen to do with their lives has really been a big factor. And it's always played really well in my mind. When I sit down to write and to work, I always think about, you know, how hard they work at their own jobs, and I try to take it as seriously as they do. But also, I have to thank the Kushners, Matt and Susan. They're the ones that gave me the chance to write this book, and they had a lot of faith in me. And the whole Deering family, as well as the Kushners, every time I sat down, I would remember that this wasn't just, you know, my story or something I was doing for fun, that it was commemorating a family that was lost. So I really took it quite seriously.
What about authors? Are there authors who influence your work? Or?
Well, some people might cringe when they hear this. Maybe they might think it's a little cliche, but definitely Shakespeare. I cannot get enough of him. I think every time, you know, you sit down to write, you have to have the goal in mind that you want to be as good as him, even if you know you can't. But Longfellow and Irving and Poe, definitely, and some of those darker guys. But also, I've really been influenced a lot by Alfred Hitchcock. You know, he's a film director, not quite so much the writer. But, you know, I feel writing a fictional work is a lot the same as making a movie. When you sit down, you got to think about each character and how they interact with every other character and everything in their environment and things like that. And that's the same thing directors have to do as well as writers. So I tend to really become fans of movie directors lately.
Travis DiNicola with author Jordan Lyons. His book, The Philadelphia First Ward Horror, is available at local bookstores.
Bonjour, Sharon.
Mais oui. Wait. I know what you're doing. You're still eating leftovers from your Bastille Day celebration. Just wave some garlic in front of it. He'll stop.
Yeah, and who doesn't celebrate Bastille Day?
I don't know, but I was so inspired last weekend by Garrison Keillor's All Bastille Day show, and I just said out loud to the radio, only on public radio would anyone
That's
dare
right.
to do such a thing.
So maybe if you missed your Bastille Day celebration, we can find something French or at least European for you to engage
okay,
in this weekend.
Okay, I like
on.
It. What will we do?
Qu'est-ce que c'est?
Actually, I have kind of an anti-European item to start.
Oh, even better.
Not that we're anti-European or anything, however...
I said that for Independence Day.
I think I did. Mm-hmm. But a reminder that there's a fabulous show at the Indiana State Museum right now called Making It in the Midwest, Artists Who Chose to Stay. The connection with Bastille Day and anti-Europe, well, it's not really anti-European. It's just that As time has gone on, more and more artists here in the Heartland have figured out how to make a living without relocating themselves to a far shore. And Rachel Perry has curated a wonderful exhibit highlighting some of the most prominent artists who have stayed in the last few years. And that's down at the Indiana State Museum right now, Making It in the Midwest, Artists Who Chose to Stay.
There you go. Indianapolis Early Music Festival is wrapping things up this weekend. It is America's oldest continually running early music series, and this weekend on the 19th, Sunday, it closes their season. They've been quite busy the past couple weeks with a Peabody concert with actors from the IRT. And the title of the show, If Music Be the Food of Love, well, you know the rest of it. So they are playing on using Indiana Repertory Theater actors joining forces with the Peabody concert tour bring together Shakespeare verse as well as music. And this is all part of the Indianapolis Early Music Festival. And these concerts are taking place at
the Basile Opera Center.
The new Basile Opera Center. That's right.
Which, if you say it just right, has a French flavor.
Well, it's actually Italian, but...
Yeah.
We'll let it, okay.
I'm sure there's some intermarrying back there in the history. And if there isn't, Frank will email us and tell us. Or Katrina might. Anyway, okay. If you are an early musician or a late musician... Well, not too late. If you are a musician, a poet, a writer, maybe you're a magician, which, Travis, I know you are.
No, just an amateur. But yes, it's
okay. Well, where I'm going with this is you might want to audition for the talent show, the variety show that's going on at Cumberland Arts Ghost Market, which is an event that's coming up on August 8th from 10 to 4. The auditions for the variety show are on Saturday, July 25th at 1 o'clock. And it's a family-friendly show, so maybe you and your young son or daughter have a duo act you'd like to try out with. You can get more information by emailing CumberlandArts@Comcast.net. CumberlandArts@Comcast.net. It's kind of an old-fashioned variety show. Those who are old enough to remember Ed Sullivan, or maybe you've seen it online, that sort of a concept. And there are also artist booths available for $20 for a 10-by-10-foot space. So if you're an artist or a craftsperson and you have something you'd like to sell at Cumberland Arts Goes to Market, you can contact the same email, CumberlandArts@Comcast.net.
There you go. Yeah, there's a lot of great outdoor concerts in parks going on right now. One of them is coming up at the Ellenberger Park on July 21st. It's part of the Symphony in the Park concert series. These are all free concerts, and this is the Indianapolis Symphony in partnership with IPL, and a whole bunch of other supporters are able to do these free outdoor concerts. And this one is on Tuesday, July 21st, 7:30 p.m., at Ellenberger Park, which is in Irvington. And again, this is free, and you're encouraged to bring your blankets and lawn chairs and picnic dinners and all that sort of stuff. And it should just be a whole lot of fun. They're going to be featuring the main theme from Jurassic Park, as well as some music from Hook, and also some more traditional pieces as well. But something certainly fun for anybody and everyone in your family. Free concert, Ellenberger Park, Tuesday the 21st.
Here's something that is a little ways away, but I wanted you to have a little bit of planning time. You are invited to put on your garden clothes and bring a covered dish made with at least one Indiana ingredient. It's a community potluck dinner to celebrate Indiana food, and it's a collective effort of Epworth United Methodist Church, which has a green team, the Heartlands Group of the Sierra Club's Hoosier Chapter, and Slow Food Indy. It's coming up on August 8th, that's a Saturday, at Epworth United Methodist Church, which is at 6450 Allisonville Road. You can hear speakers talking about the slow food movement and eating
but
local
they don't talk
produce.
Slowly.
They don't talk slowly. That's all right. You don't. What do you care? You're going to be eating. The event starts at 5:30 with demonstrations of homemade ice cream making and tomato juice canning, along with outdoor games for kids and adults. Hoosier barbecued baked chicken and soft drinks will be provided, and everybody else who comes is invited to bring $5 and that potluck dish made with one ingredient from an Indiana farm or garden, maybe even your own.
Sounds great.
August 8th.
Hey, another concert coming up. Again, another free concert. In fact, this was a
free
submission we got on our website. If you go to WFYI.org and click on public or local programming under radio and find the Art of the Matter page, there's a place there where you can submit stuff for us to include, such as the Athenaeum Pops Orchestra Concert, which is taking place at Garfield Park on Thursday, July 23rd, 7 p.m., and this one is also free, and it's conducted by Dr. Lee Jones, and it features music from the British Isles. Again, Thursday night, Garfield Park, free concert.
Ooh, you're going to have a choice to make on that Thursday night, the 23rd, because something else that's going on that involves music is the Circle City Chamber Group's next event. They are going to feature, I'm detecting a food theme here, gourmet barbecue hors d'oeuvres from the kitchen of the Terrace at Market Tower, which is where the event is being held. That's at 10 West Market Street on the third floor. And the Circle City, spit this out, Circle City, it's thinking about the barbecue I'm salivating. Circle City Chamber Group Saxophone Quartet will perform great works from jazz, classical, and contemporary realms. There will also be made-to-order ice cream sundaes.
Yum!
Yum! Doors open at 6, concerts at 7, again on July 23rd. That is a Thursday.
And the last thing I've got is just a reminder that this weekend, director Mario Vanzaga makes his Marsh Symphony on the Prairie debut with concerts both Friday night and Saturday night. Now, if you're listening to Art of the Matter, Friday night's probably too late to make it there, but you could still make it to Saturday night's concert. That Saturday night concert is at 8 p.m. Gates open at 6 p.m. out at Conna Prairie. It should be a fantastic concert on the prairie tonight.
Very good. And reminder, you've been if you're a regular listener, and we know you are, we monitor your radio dial, and we catch you listening to everything from Morning Edition to Prairie Home Companion to Car Talk to us. So you've probably heard about this, but I want to encourage you to participate in our Spirited Chase event. What we're inviting you to do is to go to our website and submit a photograph of a place that holds a special place in your heart, soul, or mind, and this might be a peaceful place, an exciting place. It might be a place where you go when you're trying to get the world back in perspective. It can be interior, exterior. It's just a place in or around our city that means something to you. So think about your spirited place and go to WFYI.org and send us a picture of it.
Very good. And we'll talk about more spirited places.
May we.
And we'll talk about more to do next week on
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Art of the Matter. Today is our special summer reading show where we revisit a number of favorite interviews with local authors from the past few months. Last up for today's show is my interview with Rita Rose about the world's tallest woman. This first aired in February.
There are many pleasant facts to know about Shelbyville, Indiana, but only one fact landed this charming town in the Guinness Book of World Records. Shelbyville was the birthplace of Sandy Allen, all 7 feet 7 and a quarter inches of her. Indianapolis writer Rita Rose was embarking on her own career as a journalist when she met and interviewed Sandy Allen for a magazine story in 1977. Over the 3 decades between then and Sandy's death in August, the two women became good friends. Rita saw in Sandy's life a story that needed to be told, a story about tolerance and acceptance and diversity. With Sandy Allen's permission and encouragement, Rita created a short novel that is a fictionalized version of Sandy's life. Called World's Tallest Woman, The Giantess of Shelbyville High, the book is especially aimed at young readers. Rita brought Sharon Gamble up to speed on the story.
Sandy Allen closed the bathroom door and pulled the string attached to the ceiling light. The bare bulb brightened the room, which had no windows, and Sandy ducked to avoid hitting her head on the fixture. With her stomach heaving, she sat on the edge of the bathtub and opened the lid of the toilet in case she threw up. She picked up a roll of toilet paper from the floor and tore off several sections, making sure she didn't use too much. Sandy thought that maybe this year would be different, that circumstances at home would improve and the teasing about her size would die down. Instead, both had gotten worse. Anxiety plagued her constantly, and along with the anxiety came the morning heaves, which always sent her to the bathroom, sometimes for as long as half an hour. She started setting the alarm clock earlier in case she had to take care of her sickness before leaving for school. Sandy stood up and leaned way over to look in the bathroom mirror. Even her face was changing, she observed, as she ran her hand over her forehead just above her eyes. Her protruding forehead seemed to be more pronounced than a few months ago, her temples sunken in at the sides. Sandy hated her broad nose and thought her lips were too full. Looking inside her mouth, she noticed that her teeth were starting to get spaces between them. Her bones seemed to be outgrowing her features. She covered her face with her hands and stood there for a minute, pulling herself together. I can't do this, she thought, as her mind wrestled with her feelings. She ended up praying, saying a prayer, asking God to make things better. Her religious upbringing was about all she had left to depend on, and even that was getting shaky.
Now, this book is not, it's not a biography. It is fiction based on a life.
It's based on several circumstances and experiences that Sandy had in high school. It was a particularly trying time for her, as you can well imagine. Junior high was also a hard time for her. And she also had issues going on at home, so she was dealing with that as well as the teasing and being an outcast at school.
As a journalist who's used to writing about things in a very straightforward, factual way, this was a little bit of a breakout for you,
yeah.
A new direction.
It was a bit of a stretch, but I really enjoyed it. Since it's based on fact, Sandy's name is really the only real name in the book. The names of other people have been changed. Some of the characters are totally fiction. Some are thinly veiled real people. It wasn't that difficult, really. I mean, I've always enjoyed reading fiction, and so I just wanted to try my hand at it. And because her biography had already been written, decided to go ahead and do this type of treatment to get the story across about her high school years.
And she did read this manuscript close to the end of her life, and she approved and gave you her blessing.
Actually, I read it to her because it was during a time when she was very sick, and she wasn't into reading, although she was a really avid reader. She liked Stephen King and, you know, Dean Koontz and all that. She had been sick and in and out of the hospital all summer, and so when I finished the manuscript in July, I knew that she wouldn't be able to read it. So I drove down to Shelbyville, and I went to the bakery that she loved so much and picked up some brownies, and then I sat there in her room at the nursing home and read it to her for the next 4 hours, and she really enjoyed it, said she couldn't wait to help me promote it, and she was very happy with the end result.
Now, lest any of our listeners think that you just suddenly appeared in Sandy Allen's life at the end of it, you met years and years ago, and what were the circumstances of that meeting?
She had become the world's tallest woman, and the Indianapolis Star had done a couple of stories on her, and, you know, they were the usual stories about how tall she was and, you know, what advantages and disadvantages. And I thought it would be interesting to find out more about her as a person, something more in-depth. And so I decided I wanted to write a magazine article. And a friend of mine who lives in Shelbyville introduced me to her. And I spent 3 days with her because she was recuperating from her brain surgery. She had a tumor on her pituitary gland, which is what made her so tall. And
So I just spent some time with her and got to know her really well, and I wrote the article, and I sent it off to some magazines, and I got bunches of rejection slips, and so I never did sell the article, but we ended up being friends for 31 years.
Wow. And there's a character in World's Tallest Woman, the Giantess of Shelbyville High, who I think might be a little bit of a stand-in for you. She's a fellow high school student, very outgoing, but feels a little bit of that sense of otherness because she, the character in this fictional setting, has moved from Indianapolis to Shelbyville and is new at the school, and you know, it's never, no matter what the circumstances are, it's never easy to change schools when you're a teenager. And so these two characters strike up a friendship. While it's a wonderful read for anybody of any age, you intentionally aimed this at teenagers, right?
Yes, especially middle school age kids. I think that that's a time when people are trying to get their own identities, and it's very hard, you know, because it's an awkward age, and they're just, you know, they're not grown-ups, and they're not children. And I think that there's a lot of bullying going on in schools, and some of it, you know, can be pretty devastating. In Sandy's case, she couldn't hide her differentness,
right.
And so, you know, there it was. And she had gone all through grade school with kids that knew her, and they didn't think anything about her height. But when she hit junior high, there were so many kids that had not seen her before, and they, of course, reacted, especially the boys. I think they were pretty much, you know, the worst as far as she was concerned. But I thought that the book, it has some messages about tolerance, about accepting people for who they are, about not judging somebody by the way they look. And I think that Sandy herself went to a lot of schools in her later years and talked to kids about this very subject. And I think she kind of redeemed herself by doing that. And I would like to carry on her message with this book.
You know, I don't want to give too much of the plot away because this really is a page-turning book, which sounds weird. What could there be that would be mysterious about it? But you know, being a high school kid is all about blending in and not standing out. And you, as you say, Sandy Allen couldn't hide her height. And the young woman journalist, the high school kid who befriends her, starts this movement that it would be so cool to see middle school and high school kids who read this book do the same thing, to actually have a school-wide project where people share, either anonymously or with their names, what it is about them that makes them feel different.
Yes, and the reason I chose that avenue is because the character, Roseanne, she feels different, but on the outside she doesn't look different, and so anybody talking to her would never know how she felt inside. She felt a bit of an outcast herself for several reasons, which do come out in the book. And so I think it's important for people to, for kids especially, to look at their classmates and you know, say, hey, you know, there's probably a really good person in there. I just don't know that person. And so, you know, there's a few messages in there about accepting people for who they are. And the fact that even though somebody might look what you want to call normal, they might be feeling other things and mm-hmm. have other things going on in their lives.
There's some great plot twists, too, that involve Roseanne using a rather wicked sense of humor to help Sandy Allen cope. She starts making her custom T-shirts.
Yes.
And say things like.
Well, the very first one was I'm with Shorty and has an arrow pointing down. And that was actually the first T-shirt that I ever made for Sandy. And I did make her T-shirts, several of them, as she was doing her different appearances. But I think my favorite one, and I think hers too, says, I like short people. I had three for lunch.
Instead of waiting for people to pick on her, she could just have the first volley to just reach out and say, hey, you know what? I'm kind of aware that I'm taller than average.
Well, and what she always said was kids are so honest. They come up and they just start pounding you with questions. How big are you? How much do you eat? How much do you weigh? You know, and adults, they don't know. They didn't know how to approach her. They would hang back and just stare. And Sandy would always say, well, I'd rather have the kids ask me questions than just have somebody, you know, stand there. And so by wearing the T-shirts, it kind of gave her the, like you said, the first the first joke on herself, and then somebody would laugh and come up and say, hey, I like your shirt, and then they'd start a conversation, and then they would find out that, you know, she doesn't bite.
You take, when you go talk to schools about this book and about Sandy Allen, you take some visuals, including, you have a cutout that was a tracing of Sandy's hand, and what do kids do when they see that?
Kids and adults seem to really like that, because the first thing they do is want to compare their hand to Sandy's, and her hand is very, very large.
Mm-hmm.
And kids, especially young kids, their hands don't even cover her palm, let alone, you know, her fingers. And so I think it's kind of a fun thing, you know, for them. And I also bring several photographs that were taken over the years, some by me, some by other people. And I also have one of her shoes. It's part of a pair that she used to take when she did her talks to the schools, and she would let kids try them on for fun. And it's an Oxford, and I also have a tennis shoe that was signed by Shaquille O'Neal that I also bring sometimes. And then
what size is this shoe?
It's a 22, triple E. Of course the best thing I have is a full size a life size standee of her, so that people can get an idea of her height and they can have their pictures taken with it. It's kind of fun.
In addition to being the subject of this novel and articles, this is a woman you were friends with for three decades. What will you miss most about her?
Oh, her sense of humor. When she was younger and could walk and get around pretty well, we used to have a lot of fun. These songs, Short People, came out at that time by Randy Newman, and some of the local DJs were having Short People parties, and I got wind of one that was going to be near my house, and I called her up, and I said, hey, there's a Short People's party. I said, I think we need to crash it. She says, I'll be right there. So she drove up, and we went in there, and they all went nuts. I mean, she came in the door, and you had to be 5'4 and under to get in, and here she came, and she was picking people up and you know, hauling them around. It was just hilarious.
Sharon Gamble with Reed Rose, author of World's Tallest Woman, The Giantess of Shelbyville High. Reed is available for school and youth group talks, and you can order the book at hawthornepub.com. That's Hawthorne, HAWTHORNE, pub.com. And you can find out much more there as well, as including contacting Rita. You can also do that at thegiantessbook.com. Again, thegiantessbook.com. It's also available through Amazon and all other booksellers. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4. I'll find out why Cumberland Arts is going to the market.
And I'll take a look at the Indiana Ballet Company. And, of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
So listen again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter is made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by grants from the Arts Council of Indianapolis and from the City of Indianapolis, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.